There is a story in the book of Luke. I'm sure we're all familiar with it, but I don't know that we've looked at it to the degree that we ought to, because it has potent implications for all of us, especially people who are called of God. I'm sure you know what I mean when I say today we are living in a modern crucible. Particularly those people who know God's truth and are trying to live His way and who want the best for our society. But what does a crucible mean in the Bible? Literally, a crucible is a vessel used for very hot processes, such as refining metals. Another meaning of the word is a very significant and difficult trial or test. A relevant word, I think, in today's situation. What's interesting about the story in Luke chapter 10, and it's the story of what we call the Good Samaritan, is the picture that there are situations when there are no people who seek to help. We could call this the title of the message today. None sought to help. And I think it helps us to understand our situation. But let's look at Luke chapter 10, beginning in verse about 29. And this is the place where the young man asked Christ what he had to do. And he gave an answer about keeping the commandments and so on. And then the fellow realized that it wasn't really an adequate answer. He said, but he, willing to justify himself, and notice that, justify himself, said unto Jesus, and who is my neighbor? He's acting like he didn't know who his neighbor was. Now, what adult person couldn't define neighbor? But this fellow tried to hide behind ignorance of what his neighbor might be, or who his neighbor might be. And Jesus answered, verse 30, said, a certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among thieves, which stripped him of his raiment and wounded him and departed, leaving him half dead. Here's this crumpled individual on the side of the road, beaten up, bloody, unable to help himself. He was that badly beaten. Not long after that, by chance, there came down a certain priest, passed by. And when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Now, I'm sure if we were to interview that priest, he would be able to justify what he did. He saw the guy, and he realized his condition, his situation, and he decided to cross the street and pass by like he had nothing to do. It wasn't his responsibility. Not long after that, another person came by, a Levite. When he came to the place, he came and looked on him, walked over and actually stood over him and looked on him. And he decided, this one isn't for me. And he also passed by on the other side. And I'm sure this Levite could justify his actions. This wasn't for him. He was too good for that, or he was too important for that. He didn't want to get dirty or something. He didn't want to be burdened with this man's problem. He didn't really care. And that's so easy to do. Verse 33. But a certain Samaritan came by. He was heading somewhere. And he came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion on him. Now, if you were to talk to the people of the day regarding a Samaritan, you wouldn't expect this from him. These were despised people. They weren't of our class. They're not worthy to live among us. These are just riffraff, people we have to tolerate. But they're nobody, really. They're not good people. Well, the Samaritan didn't act like the two righteous people that came by. He went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring oil and wine, and set him on his own beast, and brought him down the road to an inn, and took care of him there. He couldn't stay, he had to leave. But on the morrow, when he departed, he took out 2 pence and gave it to the host. And he said unto him, take care of him, and whatsoever you spend more, when I come again, I'll make it right. I'll pay you for it. Now the question was put to this young ruler, which now of these three do you think was neighbor unto him that fell among the thieves? And he said, he that showed mercy on him. Then said Jesus unto him, go and do thou likewise. The man got his answer. But it wasn't necessarily the answer he wanted to hear. It was a little embarrassing. Because there is something that the man should have known instinctively as to who his neighbor was. It wasn't his best friend. It wasn't the guy across the fence. It was this crumpled mass of dirty, beaten, bloody humanity that he found on the side of the road. Neighbor has a broader meaning than what we might think. We can't always choose our neighbors, but we can choose which of our neighbors we like and which we don't. But that doesn't fall within the definition. What happens when a whole country is experiencing similar abuses? Granted, it's figurative in this case, but what happens when a country falls into an abusive situation? And most obvious of these abuses is the loss of rights and freedoms. Can't happen? Well, it's happened many times all over the world. You see, we need to have concern for our fellow citizens' welfare. Ours, and particularly ours, is a unique responsibility. Oh yeah, God rules in the kingdom of men. Daniel 4:17 tells us that. It's undeniable that God is in control of what is happening in the world and in society. He always has been. But He's directing certain things, and He's allowing other things. Let's look at Daniel 4:17. I don't have a lot of scriptures, so I better take time with as many or as few that I do have here. 4:17. This matter is by the decree of the watchers. That's an interesting phrase. What does that mean? And the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomsoever he will, and sets up over it the basest of men. Think back through history. How many excellent leaders has the world ever known? I think most of them, if we were to list them out, would fall within the nation of Israel, the greater nation of Israel. David certainly would qualify, and there were others. The majority of the world's rulers would fall in this category of being the basest of men. Criminals, abusive, murderers. Stalin was supposedly listed as having killed or caused to be killed 70 million of his own people by various means, executions and famines and whatever. Okay? Is that a base guy or what? But the point is, what do people do? What do we do in those situations? Now, knowing that God is ruling in the kingdoms of men, should we be blasé about what God is doing? Should we be ambivalent about it all? Oh, God's going to take care of it. We won't worry. So in our minds, we might tend to sideline what God is actually doing as far as being involved in it in any way. One of the things that we should be doing, and they're not all necessarily physical involvement, but certainly mental involvement, we need to be wise as to what's going on, why it's going on, and how we need to be involved in it. Now think of the people around us, our neighbors from anywhere, anybody. How should we respond to them? Think of them as spiritually and educationally crumpled, bloody people on the side of the road. What should we do for them in a informational or in a spiritual sense? Granted, they're not physically that way, but they might as well be. Spiritually hobbled for lack of knowledge, for not knowing what's going on or why. There's things that we can add to the picture that help people understand, even if it doesn't bring them to conversion necessarily. Being lights in the world is like that. Knowing our neighbor and knowing what we should be doing as it regards our neighbor. We need to understand biblical prophecy, because it's laying out in advance the picture of what God is going to ultimately do. We have a hope beyond present world conditions that the world does not have. Do we project any of that to the people we know? Not so much among ourselves, that's a given. But do we project any of that to people around us without being necessarily off-putting? You know, we need to be sensitive as to what the hearer would accept of us. But do we add that little bit of information appropriately placed now and then? In Revelation 19:10, it tells us that the testimony of Jesus Christ is the spirit of prophecy. And that's worth a minute. Let's go there. 19 verse 10. It says, "And I fell at his feet to worship him, and he said unto me, See thou do it not. I am your fellow servant, and of your brethren that have the testimony of Jesus. Worship God. For the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy." Do we have in ourselves a good sense of Bible prophecy? Does it in any way frame our hope and our perspective on life? And do we project any of that to people around us? Who would benefit from it? Again, with discretion, sure. But do we do that? Because I pose that to us as one of our responsibilities as being a good neighbor. Into understanding Bible prophecy, we need to be knowledgeable of satanic agendas. There are unseen forces in operation in this world. Daniel 10, we were there just a minute ago. Let's go back to Daniel 10. This is very revealing, and there aren't many places like this that lay it out as clearly. But in Daniel 10, verses 11 through 14, there's a glimpse into the spirit world that we tend to not think about, but it's there. It's going on. Daniel 10, verse 11. "And he said unto me, O Daniel, a man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak unto you, and stand upright, for unto you am I now sent. And when he had spoken this word unto me, I stood trembling. And he said unto me, Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you didst set your heart to understand and to chasten yourself before God, your words were heard, and I am come for your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. But lo, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the king of Persia." In this particular time frame, there was a great spiritual battle going on to change the course of history. This spirit force understood what God was going to do and was fighting against him. And this battle went on for 3 weeks. Can you get the picture? There are, at times, massive struggles between God and evil spirits. God's in control. He's going to win. But boy, at times, it ain't easy. But we need to understand that picture, that there is a spiritual force working under the scenes, working behind the scenes that we are not necessarily aware of. In Ephesians 6:12, it kind of reinforces that. 6:12. Familiar verse, we know this. "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places." That is telling us a lot about the world in which we live. Now, it isn't the spiritual forces themselves, because they act through individuals. They act through people. Do we realize that? And does that in any way shape our thinking? and our awareness of how God is working behind the scenes to bring forth His plan. In Revelation chapter 3, there's a very interesting message written specifically to God's people, of all things. You wouldn't think something like this would be said of God's people, but here it is. Revelation 3, beginning in verse 14. "And unto the angel of the church of Laodiceans write, These things saith the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. I know your works, that you're neither hot or cold. I'd prefer that you be either hot or cold. So then, because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew you out of my mouth." And the Greek word there is not spit, it's more like vomit. These people actually make God sick. Can we understand that? You see, these people think themselves to be in wonderfully good shape, and they have no real foundation. They're not committed one way or the other. It was Dr. Hay many, many years ago who made a controversial association. It was kind of startling at the time, but I think he had a point. He made the point that we are living in a Laodicean culture. We could reflect back to that word crucible. The culture in which we lived is generally this way, and it rubs off on the church. We didn't originate it, but we sort of absorbed it from the surround. How many people are ambivalent in all this stuff that's going on? They don't really care one way or the other. God will take care of it. You know, it's kind of like that God will do it all for you attitude. Well, granted, He will do it all. But the question is, where should we be with regard to it? What is our involvement requirement? Can we be neither hot nor cold? That's a wonderful. You get along beautifully that way in the world. But is that what God wants of His people? Verse 17. Here's their excuse. This is their justification. This is how they explain away the way they are. "Because you say, I am rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing. I'm okay, boy, this is great. And you don't know that in fact you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked." God is saying that to people He called out of this world with an expectation of what they were going to do with their lives. Here's what they haven't done, verse 18. "I counsel you to buy of me gold tried in the fire, that thou mayest be truly rich. And buy of me white raiment, that you may be truly clothed, and that the shame of your nakedness isn't so obvious. And anoint your eyes with eye salve, that you may see." Their problem? They didn't really see their own spiritual condition. When you look through the messages to the seven churches, it's this one that is the most that is the most stinging indictment when you really think about it. And the problem was something so simple. They weren't committed one way or the other. You couldn't pin them down. You couldn't tell where they were or where they're coming from. They really weren't involved, mentally or spiritually, with what God was doing. He offers them a suggestion here, more than a suggestion. Verse 19, as many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Be zealous, therefore, and repent. Is there a clue there as to what might be coming? As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. He is going to chasten, he says, of these people. Not just his church necessarily, but along with it, or let's say society, the culture in which we live. They're going to be rebuked and chastened, and I'm sure God's people along with it. Does that not apply? It's to them. This is written to the church, isn't it? He tells them, look, I'm standing here. I'm right at the door. I'm knocking away. You know I'm out there. You could hear my voice. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come in to him and will sup with him and he with me. The challenge is to overcome. We have to overcome this problem. And the problem is lethargy, neither hot nor cold. To him that overcometh, will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and am set down with my Father in his throne. He that has the ears to hear, let him hear. Laodiceanism, as it regards God's people, is good men doing nothing. People who have the ability to do things that they could and should be doing, don't do it. And that, unfortunately, is the prevailing societal approach in the world and in the culture in which we live. It rubs off. Where God's people ought to stand out, a lot of times they don't. People become satisfied with quiet living. Problem is with that. They become unrehearsed in handling affliction. They're not prepared for it. It's almost better to be under some kind of stress, some kind of situation, and to prevail over it than to just be floating along with no problems. You see, the problem with these Laodiceans is they have the inability to correctly assess their true situation. Oh, God will do it all. God will take care of everything. Don't worry about it. Those people who thrive are those who are living under persecution. Those thriving spiritually are dealing with situations that cause stress. One thing we know about this message to Laodicea is that God is watching us. He knows us. He's been to our house. And it's particularly for us. We need to assess exactly what a Laodicean is and how to respond appropriately. The most obvious thing is to shake off lukewarmness. become zealous. Now, I sort of alluded to this earlier, but let's go back to an original, earlier idea. And that is how we interact with our quote-unquote neighbors. 1 Thessalonians 4. 1 Thessalonians 4. Verse 12. God tells us that we ought to walk honestly toward them that are without, that you may have lack of nothing. Now, weren't the Laodiceans people that thought they lacked nothing? We're to walk honestly towards them that are without. These are not necessarily our brethren. This is outsiders, we could say. Let's go over to Galatians 6:10. Because this applies to us. This explains how we should be operating in a world like ours. 6:10. As we therefore have opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially unto them who are of the household of faith. So not only being lukewarm towards the world, there's a chance that we could be lukewarm towards one another. And God makes a point that we need to be particularly concerned for our brethren. Where do you find a better neighbor than that? We have today sinister elements at work all around the world and even in our own country, more so than at any time that we have ever known. There are elements that want to deny us our rights and our liberties, abusing innocent victims because it's the people who can't help themselves that are going to be impacted the most with all of this. We live in a politically correct environment where our voice is silenced. They don't want us to even have the chance to say what needs to be said. Second Chronicles 7:14. 2 Chronicles 7:14, very well-known verse. But it's one that fits the bill here better than anything we could say. 7:14. We've sung this on occasion. If my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then will I hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and will heal their land. This is not only personal, it's societal. I will heal their land. But the crux of this is his people doing what he asks of them. Let's look at Malachi 3:16, another verse that is very, very well known. But there's things about it that maybe we ought to look at. Malachi 3. You probably know it by heart anyway. Then they that feared the Lord spoke often one to another. And the Lord hearkened and heard it. And a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Lord and that thought upon his name. Do you realize that when we talk to one another, particularly when we talk to one another regarding his name, when his name's involved, when his name comes up, he hears us and he remembers. And he writes it down for posterity. Verse 17, "And they shall be mine, says the Lord of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels, and I will spare them as a man spares his own son that serves him." What do you think they're talking about? What do you think qualifies to be remembered in God's book of remembrance? Is it idle chitty-chat? Or is it conversation of consequence? It's not a small thing. It's a big thing with God. Verse 18. "Then shall you return." That means go back to where you were before. "And then shall you return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serves God and him that serves him not." Where do you suppose that's going to take place? Where and when? Those people who are involved in God's purpose today are going to be remembered, and they're going to be used in a very profound way. In Matthew 10:16, we're told that we ought to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. It's not a hard picture to understand. But to be wise as a serpent, you've got to be paying attention. You've got to be discerning the situation. What's going on? Can we compare what we see going on with God's plan as it's laid out in prophecy? That takes some serious discernment, let's face it. But that's what God expects of us. Be wise as serpents, though harmless as doves. We're not throwing rocks at anybody. We're not shooting at anybody. But we got to know what's going on and why. Hebrews 5:14 tells us something about someone who is experienced in the faith. And this too is not a suggestion. It's what we really ought to be. Hebrews 5:13. Hebrews 5:11. "Of whom we have heard many things to say, and hard to be uttered, seeing that you are dull of hearing." It was a problem then. "For when, for the time you ought to be teachers, you have need that one teach you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God, and are become such as have need of milk and not of strong meat." This was their spiritual condition at that time. "For everyone that uses milk is unskillful in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. But strong meat belongs to them that are of full age, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil." We need to be exercising our senses of discernment. That's one of the requirements of being not lukewarm. A lot of people like to operate under what we could call outsourced thinking. In other words, they let other people do their thinking for them. That's fine in some situations and for a time. But there's got to come a point in time where we're of age in the truth, to where we can exercise our own senses of discernment. Discernment is important because it helps us sort out the good from the bad. It helps us understand what we ought to be doing. We can so easily become unwitting agents of sinister agendas. We're living in an age of unprecedented psychological warfare. There's a war for control. Not only for control of the political scene, but a war for the control of our own minds and thoughts and actions. God's prophecy is reality. And it's important to have a sense of what it's saying. On the other hand, we have some people who just love to be embroiled in doomsday scenarios. Again, that's something that has its place, but if that's all there is, it's easy to become very imbalanced. That's not a healthy approach if that's all there is. Our thoughts and our actions have to be formed around a positive assessment, a positive course of action. We need to know what's wrong to be able to conceive of what change is needed. Those people who don't like to be involved in the world situation and what's going on, let me point something out to you. You know, we can operate detached right now. Easy to do. But think about this. We are going to be dropped in the middle of a very potent, profound situation. Because we're going to go from now to God's kingdom. Suddenly, we're going to be put in control. And if we haven't been exercising our senses all along to know what's wrong, to know why it's wrong, and to know what needs to be done about it, we're going to be fish out of water. This is training. We, especially in this age, with the complexities and the stuff that's going on, and all the mind-blowing stuff, it's beyond comprehension, a lot of it. This is training for that day when God is going to do like it says in Malachi 3. He's going to call up those people. He's going to set them in a place where they discern between the righteous and the unrighteous. God's preparing us for rule in His kingdom that may not be that far away. There is a price for lukewarmness. And we want to make sure we don't pay it.